Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome back to day two of our Standing Advisory Group meeting. We have another busy agenda today, so we'll get started right away. Yesterday was an excellent day. We appreciated all the input we received, and we received quite a bit, and we'll look forward to getting back to you on our comments and reaction to that input at our next sessions. So we had lively breakout groups yesterday. Tent cards weren't needed to be placed up, so it made the conversation even livelier. And we're now going to report back. The way we're going to do this is we're going to cover each topic, and we'll talk about the first topic, and then we'll ask for your input on that, and then we'll move to the second topic, et cetera. So I think, Jennifer, you're going to begin this with the consideration of the risk of material misstatement. And let me pass it along to you.
Before we do that, I know we have some SAG members on the phone, not sure exactly who's on. So if you could please, if you're participating by phone, just announce your name so we have a clear indication.
Hal Schroeder.
And Shelley Stein.
Okay, Hal and Shelley, thank you. And again, for both of you, if you have a comment when we start discussing, just indicate that you have a comment. We'll take note of that and call on you in order. So what I'll be talking about is there was three discussion topics yesterday, total of six questions. The first topic dealt with identifying, assessing risk of material misstatement, and really the main focus there was whether certain estimates or those with a wide range of measurement uncertainty should be, there should be a presumption that there's a fraud risk. And our group, which is Group B, spent a significant amount of time on that. And when Marty, Greg, and I were getting together last night and reviewing our comments, we recognized there was a lot of similarities among the three groups, and thought that each of us would talk about a specific individual topic, and then the other groups, well, kind of, they had some other things other groups will bring out, so they'll point those out. But to get us started, regarding the presumption of the fraud risk, there is consensus in our group that fair value measurements with a high degree of measurement uncertainty have a higher degree of inherent risk. So we had acknowledgement about that. And the consensus that auditors should give those measurements additional audit attention. However, I think the group was pretty strong in feeling that those types of measurements should not be labeled as a fraud risk. There was concern that by doing a fraud risk, it may there may be other risks that auditors may not be focused on, and it's not the appropriate characterization. And labeling it as a fraud risk does not in and of itself guarantee an appropriate response. There was a consensus that if a presumption exists for fair value measurements with a high degree of measurement uncertainty, then other accounting estimates with a high degree of uncertainty should also be a fraud risk. For example, loan loss estimates, environmental liabilities, litigation contingencies, et cetera. So the group acknowledged that there are certain estimates that carry a risk and should be given appropriate audit attention, but the group didn't feel that those should be labeled as a fraud risk. But there is this population of estimates that do carry higher risk. As far as audit procedures and what procedures should be performed on those type of estimates, the group felt that it's premature to mandate specific procedures because many of these are unique and carry different risks within themselves. So mandating specific procedures was difficult for the group to do. The group acknowledge that there's some procedures in ISA 540 which talk about estimation uncertainty, and some of those procedures may be appropriate. And we had one individual in our breakout group when we were talking about SAS 99 and the fraud risk presumption that's in our fraud standard right now and certain procedures that are outlined in that. And the individual pointed out when that fraud standard was developed, there was a wealth of information about frauds and revenue recognition and where, you know, fraud occurred by manipulating revenue. And so it was easier to tailor specific procedures for those type of risks, which were included in the fraud standard. But contrasting that with estimates and these different types of estimates, we don't have that wealth of information today, so it's premature to develop specific procedures. Regarding what this population of estimates with higher risk should be, our group did not spend a significant amount of time identifying those factors. We talked about level two, level three type assets, but in measurements that seem to have a higher risk, but we did not spend a significant amount of time focusing on exactly what the characteristics are, but there was certain recognition that certain estimates do carry higher risk. So that's a summary of our discussion. I'll turn it over to the other two breakout groups for additional commentary they have.
I'll start with Group A. With respect to the first question on the presumption, our group also agreed that it was not a fraud. This was not a fraud risk presumption. However, the group did we had a consensus that the presumption that a fair value measurement with a high degree of measurement uncertainty is a significant risk, and so our group agreed that it at least at that was at the significant risk level for the in looking at a high degree of material uncertainty, measurement uncertainty. Also, with respect to question two, our group came up with some possible procedures to recommend in this area. One being the auditor should evaluate the track record of management in making accurate estimates. Secondly, the auditor should evaluate the model if a model is being used and determine if the model is generally accepted. And thirdly, the auditor should consider alternative assumptions in place of management's assumptions and then use those alternative assumptions to calculate a point estimate in order to evaluate management's range of estimates. And then finally, the auditor should obtain third-party verification of the information. For example, the auditor should obtain an independent bid from a broker-dealer. With respect to the third question on the six factors that were outlined in the briefing paper, our group was of the opinion that that's a good starting point for evaluating whether fair value measurements have a high degree of measurement uncertainty, and we had no additional factors at that time to add to that list. Any other comments?
I would add on the factors that there was a suggestion that we looked at other standard setters for some additional factors that that some of the standards, I think it was the ASB draft standard, has some factors we might want to consider also.
For the third breakout session, consistent with the first two, overall there was a concern about presuming a fraud risk. However, there was overall a belief that there needs to be a higher level of skepticism for these fair value measurements that have a high degree of measurement uncertainty.
Comments from any of the groups, from the SAG members or and observers on this particular topic?
One of the facts that I'd like to point out is that it was mentioned that although fair values with a high degree of measurement uncertainty was a general consensus that it shouldn't be presumed to be a fraud risk, and the comment was made that it should be considered a significant risk. Significant risk is has been defined in AS7. And in our risk assessment standards, which were when they were exposed, as a risk that requires special attention by the auditor. So I think talking about these matters as significant risk does, in some sense, accomplish the same objective to some degree. And I think there wasn't anybody who doesn't agree that, at least in the group I was in, that these measurements by their nature, require special attention. It was the labeling of fraud risk that seemed to trouble most of the folks that were in the group that I was in, and I gather that was the consensus of the other groups. There was also, I think, a concern in the group that we were in that we had pointed out that if one looked over recent years and did an analysis of inspection findings in part one of all of the inspection reports, you'd see a good percentage of comments pertaining to the lack of professional skepticism around fair values. And that goes back to, you know, before there were inactive markets, comments pertaining to impairment assessment of goodwill and assessing the fair value of the goodwill. So it would go back a bit, and you'd see that fair values that have a high degree of measurement uncertainty, for instance, such as, you know, what's the valuation of goodwill, not just securities in inactive markets, do present audit challenges, and as I said, a fair degree of audit and inspection comments on that subject. So again, this will be continue to be high on our list in terms of it was mentioned yesterday that maybe there's a need for another alert. We'll consider that, and I think that may come up again with respect to some of the other items that we discussed in the breakout groups yesterday. But certainly in our revision, as we're working through the fair value standard, we will consider the fact of the number of deficiencies we find in this area. And the general view that this is an area that requires special attention by the auditor and how to get that. Again, can you call it? Arnold Schilder.
I noted that Jennifer quoted inherent risk, which as such was not mentioned in our group, but I think that's helpful. And your last comments, Marty, make me think of that at the IAASB, we recently have stepped up a liaison project with the IASB to comment only on auditability aspects of accounting standards. And this discussion also highlights, and it was mentioned in our group as well, that part of the uncertainty you cannot take away by whatever good audit you do. So that goes back indeed to the inherent nature and comments that may be fed back to accounting standard setters as well from an auditability perspective. So I think it's important to keep that in the context of the whole as well in mind.
Good. Those are good points. Thanks, Arnold. Others? Well, I think the lack of comment is, I think, consistent with the consensus that came from the three groups around these topics. So I think with that, why don't we move on to Brian. I think you're covering topic two, Brian Degano, and that was the evaluating the adequacy of fair value disclosures. Again, we made the point in the paper about the increasing amount of qualitative disclosures and the importance of those qualitative disclosures around fair values, and was there a need for additional guidance to auditors with respect to evaluating the adequacy of those additional disclosures?
Thanks, Marty. On balance, our breakout group noted that as footnote disclosures move further away from providing more detail of amounts that are already recognized in the financial statements, the process for collecting that information may not be as robust, and there could be room for improvements in those processes. And as a result, auditors probably could use more direction on evaluating the qualitative nature of disclosures. However, there was no clear solution on how to provide that additional direction. The group also noted that the issue does go beyond fair value measurement disclosures. The existing audit direction was created largely when footnotes were just a more detailed disclosure of amounts recognized in the financial statements. And if the FASB requires additional disclosures in the financial statements, those disclosures would be subject to internal control of financial reporting, and management would need to place controls and processes around those disclosures. In some cases, the preparers might focus largely on the point estimate being recognized in the financial statements, and the sensitivity analysis around that estimate may not receive as much attention, and that could place auditors in a challenging position to gather that information. As well, it was noted that an auditor could have a hard time winning an argument over the nature of a qualitative disclosure, as the decisions are very subjective.
I just add one or two comments on that from the room I was in with Brian, just to make sure everybody understood the point that was made. Gary Kaberuk, who's not here today, made the point that, and I think it's a good one, he also made it up at FASAC recently at a meeting I attended, that the nature of a lot of disclosures that are coming out of the FASB, and it's not only pertaining to fair value, but certainly in this area, some time ago, most disclosures in the footnotes really were derivatives, I don't want to use that word, really were derived from double entry bookkeeping in the general ledger. And they were just a further breakdown, if you will, of what was in the general ledger and numbers that were subjected to that kind of a systematic control. More of the disclosures now are outside of those processes, management determining other types of, you know, qualitative information around that that's not subject to the traditional types of controls. As that's being done, I think Gary even pointed out, you know, preparers probably have better processes and do a better job with respect to the disclosures that were the former than the processes with respect to the latter, i.e. those of the sensitivity analysis type of disclosures. So he saw it as certainly a risk from the preparer's perspective. I think, you know, there have to be internal controls over financial reporting around those types of, you know, type 2 disclosures as well. But if management is principally getting a value from a pricing service as to here's the estimate of the value of this complex security, a CDO squared, we think it's, you know, 65 cents on the dollar, it's pretty difficult then for the auditor to make a determination about, well, if those inputs change slightly, since maybe there isn't a lot of transparency around the inputs, if those inputs change slightly to another reasonable amount, what effect would that have on the financial statements? So it goes. So that's the challenge we're talking about here, and I think Greg Jonas made an important point yesterday. We were talking about it later in the day, Lynn and I, that, you know, evaluation of whether financial statements present fairly, maybe it's well understood with respect to the score sheet on what kind of P&L adjustments somebody has. Is it off by 2% or 3% net income? But in looking at qualitative disclosures and assessing whether or not all of the disclosures that should be there are there, and are those qualitative disclosures appropriate? Now, what's the standard for assessing presents fairly there? It's maybe not quite as clear as the math on the how far off is the P&L of the balance sheet. So, again, we had a lively discussion around that, not a particular answer, but that there are challenges here that we think we need to address, maybe not only with respect to these types of disclosures pertaining to fair value, but disclosures in general, when you get outside of the, you know, the typical and analytical details of general ledger breakdown. I see a couple of cards up, or at least one. Joe Carcello?
Marty, maybe I misunderstood you, but what I heard you say is that controls around the GL and kind of the accounting numbers in the typical corporation are likely better than controls around other, let's say, softer, more qualitative disclosures that are also required in the 10, in the K and the Q. If I understood you right, that may be true, but my read, and I'm not an attorney, so you might want to talk to some attorneys, but my read of 404A and 404B and my read of 302 would suggest that the Securities and Exchange Commission and Congress in the Act expect sufficient controls around anything that is required to be disclosed. That's the whole point of 302. It talks about disclosure controls and procedures. So I think to give the corporate community a pass on this would be a mistake.
I agree 100%. No disagreement that the controls have to, I think I mentioned that in my comments, that those qualitative controls are still subject to the internal controls of the financial reporting requirements. I think it was just observed, though, that the nature of the traditional inherent controls around things coming out of double entry bookkeeping are a little different than the qualitative controls, that the controls around qualitative subjective, you know, information, and it's more challenging. Maybe not that, obviously I was not making a comment that they're not there. I was commenting on the greater challenge in preparing those estimates, and therefore presumably a greater challenge on the part of the auditor in auditing those types of qualitative disclosures, which might indicate the need for more, and that's what we'll be thinking about in our project here, might indicate the need for more robust requirements in our as on our project on fair value auditing standard, although some of the people in the room that I was in would say they recognize the issue but don't need more prescriptive audit requirements around it. They think that the audit standards already require auditors to evaluate those disclosures. I don't know if any auditors want to comment on that point. Ted White?
We're here.
I didn't see you out there, Ted.
I'm hiding. Your qualifications notwithstanding, I agree with the difficulty in this area, but the main reason I wanted to say something is I would suggest that the PCOB put enormous amounts of emphasis on this area. From an end user's perspective, I think the quality of disclosures around fair value is just absolutely critical. There's too many complexities in this area. There are, you know, too many moving pieces in regards to the auditing standards that I think, frankly, most institutions, I'm sorry, the accounting standards that most institutions don't support at this point. And, you know, the quality of disclosures is the basis on which, you know, investors of various stripes can make all kinds of judgments in the quality of how fair value is done. And this is an area where the PCOB, I think, can help just immensely. So I would just place lots of emphasis on this.
Thanks for that point.
We haven't finished the summary from the other groups.
Right. Thanks for that point. I think some of the evidence we have in that area, the points we're just making, is probably based upon some anecdotal evidence from yesterday's discussions. As we go forward with this project, it would be important for us maybe to gather some more empirical evidence around the disclosures that are qualitative and the need for better auditing procedures around those than are there today or not. But if we take your point 100%, we think we should put enormous attention on that, and that's why we have this on our agenda. Jeff Mahoney?
I just wanted to second Ted's point that I think having robust disclosures in this area of fair value measurements, as well as in a number of other areas, impairments, loan loss reserves being two others, are a very important tool for investors to mitigate some of the issues raised by potentially inaccurate management estimates of fair value measures or these other areas of accounting which involve a significant amount of judgment and estimate. In the area of fair values, qualitative information is important surrounding how those estimates of fair value are done. Quantitative information is important about the valuation inputs, the sensitivities that you mentioned earlier. Quantitative information about unrealized gains and losses, other changes in the fair value positions, all of that is very important information to the investor community in looking and getting useful information from these fair value estimates. And again, I'll make another plug, as I did yesterday. There's a lot of discussion of this in the white paper that we issued last July that's available on our website. Another earlier point Joe mentioned with respect to qualitative disclosures versus quantitative disclosures, I would point out, and I think Peter could probably speak to this more than I can, but I know there's has been a number of times in recent years where the disclosures that the FASB has required, they received comments from the preparer community pointing to a preference of qualitative disclosures over quantitative disclosures. So to the extent that there is more qualitative disclosures now appearing in accounting standards, and part of that can be attributed to requests from the preparer community to have those disclosures rather than quantitative disclosures.
Good. Thanks, Jeff. Lynn?
This issue came up during some of the public hearings we held at the Treasury Committee, and there was input provided by some investors during those hearings as well, that with respect to the auditors, they'd like more communication from or disclosure out of auditors with respect to key assumptions and estimates and what the auditors honestly thought about those. So that was something that we heard over there during those meetings, that investors are looking for that information. I think part of the issue here, though, is outside what you can work on, because I do think some of the issues just relate flat out to what the FASB, the standard setter, requires as disclosure, and it's very clear investors are looking for more than what they're getting out of the current standards. And I, you know, that's just not in your bailiwick either. The FASB or the SEC needs to take on that and deal with that issue. But as it relates to the auditors, it was very clear to us that from the public hearings and what we heard, they are looking for more information from the auditors, in particular how they audit it and what they honestly think about those assumptions and judgments made by management.
Good. And those are good comments, and we agree with those points. There were some, I've given some summaries from our room. I think Greg had some additional comments from your room on this subject.
Yes. Similar to the other group, the our group was general consensus that the PCAOB might consider guidance in evaluating the adequacy of all disclosures, not just the fair value disclosures in isolation. Also, our group suggested that the PCAOB might, as an interim step, might need to emphasize the risk associated with the fair value disclosures, and this could be done in a practice alert.
Our group, Group B, had similar views regarding the importance of disclosures regarding, when our group focused on fair value disclosures. Our group also acknowledged or pointed out that today, looking at SEC enforcement actions or even PCAOB enforcement actions, there haven't been many of those type of enforcement proceedings with an emphasis on disclosures or a lack of disclosures, and in part that could be because of the difficulty in evaluating or saying they're blatantly wrong, and said that perhaps auditors view disclosures as a lower risk because they're not seeing much penalties being taken for disclosures that are perhaps less than adequate, and said, you know, one tool might be to have more of those type of enforcement proceedings so that to alert auditors and preparers as well as far as, you know, the importance of those disclosures.
Jeff, did you have your card up again, or is that from earlier? Thanks. Any other input from the group on this important subject of not just fair value disclosures, but the increasing amount of qualitative disclosures, the importance of disclosures to investors, and the need for further auditing guidance? Great. Well, thanks for that input. And Greg, I think you're taking the lead on the third topic.
Yes, the third topic, the final topic, is using the work of a specialist. There were two questions in this area. The first one, should the same requirements apply for using an outside specialist and an employee specialist? Our group is of the view that the objectives should be the same for both outside and employee specialists. It's just a matter of how you get there. That is, the auditor should similarly supervise and evaluate the work of an employee specialist and an outside specialist. The second question had to do with what additional direction should a standard provide when evaluating the work of an auditor specialist. We had a good discussion on this and generally came to the view that the auditor should be required to have a greater level of understanding of the assumptions and methods of the auditor specialist than currently exist today. And auditors also cannot treat the specialist report as a black box. That is, the auditor should determine if the results contained in the specialist report are the results reasonable. So we came to the view that the auditor cannot just treat the report, you got a report, here it is, and leave it alone. The auditor has to have an understanding of the assumptions and methods going in, and then have an understanding of the results that come out of the report and make sure those results are reasonable. The other groups have any other additional comments to add?
Our group was along similar lines as far as specialists that are within the firm, employees of the firm versus external should be same type of procedures. Auditors should, the objective for a standard should be similar, although some of the requirements may be different. For example, evaluating or specialists within a firm, employees of the firm would be required to adhere to auditor independence rules versus imposing that doesn't make sense on a third-party specialist, so you would look to objectivity there. So there may be some differences in requirements. We didn't spend a significant amount of time about, as perhaps maybe your group did, on the exact procedures that the auditor should perform in evaluating a specialist's work. But the group did acknowledge that the current language in AU 336, which is our part of our standards, kind of is more of a negative assurance type of review, that you kind of rely on the specialist unless something comes to your attention. And there was agreement that that should be stronger as far as evaluating the work. The group also acknowledged that you're engaging a specialist because there's expertise that you need that you don't have in evaluating audit, gaining sufficient competent audit evidence. And the group also acknowledged that, the auditor needs that, they as part of their audit evidence, they do not make reference to a specialist in the auditor's report, so they need to take responsibility and do sufficient work. But, I think there was some discussion of challenges on how far do you go recognizing that you don't otherwise have the expertise. You need to hire someone for expertise in oil and gas or engineering or a lot of different types of specialties.
Based on the comments I've heard, including the discussion in my group plus meeting with the other teams afterwards about their groups, it does seem like there's a fair degree of support for some revision to our existing standard around the use of specialists. The existing PCOB standard covers use of specialists, both a specialist hired by management and a specialist engaged by the auditor. And there seemed to be a fair degree of agreement that there's probably differences in terms of those two types of specialists. The work done by a specialist engaged by management was viewed as essentially, pretty much the same work as if it were done by management. And that should be part of an evidence standard, which is where the IAASB has management's expert basically in its audit evidence standard. But then looking at the, if you move into a separate standard with respect to the auditor's use of the specialist or the auditor's expert, as it's referred to in the IAASB standard, there was at least some debate that I saw about adopting the language that's in the ISA. I think it was generally felt that we needed to strengthen the guidance we had today, but that there was at least some debate about the ISA indicates that if the expert work involves use of significant assumptions and methods, the auditor needs to evaluate the relevance and reasonableness of those assumptions and methods that the expert looked at. It was less clear in certain areas. People generally felt that, well, in financial instruments, the auditor could look at the expert's work and understand the assumptions, the type of model that was used. Was it a discounted cash flow model or a Black-Scholes model or whatever it might be? Could look at some of the inputs in terms of what default rates were or loss and event of default or things of that nature. When you got into things like a geological survey, though, that an engineering study for purposes of measuring the amount of oil and gas in the ground, it wasn't as clear that the auditor had necessarily the ability to challenge his expert's work in evaluating the assumptions that went into the methods to measure the oil and gas in the ground. So I guess there was at least some debate that came up about what the auditor has to do in looking at his expert's work and in reviewing that, and to what degree did the auditor have to understand those key assumptions, which were in this case were engineering or geological assumptions. So I don't know if anybody else has any comments on that, or if that was a debate in anybody else's room, but I'll be looking for comments now. I see Greg Jonas first.
I would encourage the board to avoid any impression in crafting a standard that it's fine for the auditor to outsource complex fair value measurements to outsiders. I think the auditor's relationship to a fair value measurement is different from the auditor's relationship to, say, an actuarial valuation or a legal opinion on a legal matter. I think fair values are a core competence of the audit profession. It would be kind of like a heart surgeon outsourcing the surgery part of the medical service to others. I think it's a mistake for the profession to do that. And I think we should expect auditors to be experts in fair value measurement. Now, that doesn't mean that the auditor doesn't, from time to time, need to consult with experts. Just as in inventory valuation, from time to time, the auditor needs to employ, say, an engineering expert. But the role of the engineer, in my example with inventory, is to enhance the auditor's competence. It's not to outsource the valuation of the inventory. So I think we need to be very careful here because, you know, complex fair valuations are new to many auditors, and there's a real tendency to want to treat that like we treat actuaries. And I think it's a strategic mistake for the profession, but I also think it doesn't result in the quality of auditing that we really need in this area.
Thanks, Greg. Galen?
Follow up on Greg's comment. I think I would agree with much of what he's saying. However, there's also this tendency to say, well, if we get a specialist, we can kind of rely on them, and maybe our skepticism level might not be as high. And I think that's one of the problems that we're running into. On the issue of outsourcing, regardless of the size of firms, they are turning to these outside specialists, and the smaller the firm is, the less likely they're going to have that in-house. I do agree that the engagement team needs to become more conversant and more knowledgeable on valuation issues, but simply said, they might have to go to outside bodies to obtain an opinion. When they do that, I believe personally that two things are required.
that has to be, that relationship has to be independent with respect to the issuer. That isn't any different than if they go retain another auditing firm to do a part of the audit. And then the second thing, I think that that valuation firm has to express some sort of clarity of what their responsibility is, what the opinion is that they've expressed. They simply can't provide the auditor a discussion and an Excel spreadsheet and some calculations and say, here you go. I think if they're going to be a specialist, being a specialist has to mean something, which means that they provide an opinion, that they provide some sort of expression of what they believe, and that opinion has to be independent. Simply my opinion.
Thanks, Galen. I'd like to follow up a little bit on that, Craig. It's an interesting point. I just want to make sure we get your views correct here. With respect to the auditor using a specialist in connection with the fair value of financial instruments, you were making a distinction between the auditor's, you viewed the auditor's responsibilities there versus when the auditor used an expert to help them determine the amount of oil in the ground as part of an engineering valuation. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair. I liken fair value measurements to be analogous to inventory valuation. When we're auditing the books of a manufacturing company, I think we expect our auditors to understand the inventory, understand how it's made. You literally become an expert in the process of creating the inventory. You understand its shelf life. You understand what makes it go obsolete. You can't do your job otherwise. Now, you may need an engineer to educate you, but we expect our auditors to become experts in the nature of the inventory and the accounting risks that result from that. Similarly, I remember had some clients who had asbestos-related litigation. I think it was right to expect that the auditor would become somewhat of an expert, not in the legal issues, but in understanding the nature of asbestotic-related disease, talk to epidemiologists. I mean, you do a lot of work. You don't just outsource to somebody who has on their hat expert in these areas, and we wouldn't expect our auditors to do that. Yet, I think in the area of fair value measurement, you use the example, Marty, of a CDO squared. You know, we just almost say, well, that's too complex for any human to understand, so let's go get an expert to tell me and treat that expert as a black box. I give the expert inputs, the expert comes back with an output, and I accept the output because I have no basis to do otherwise. I think we should expect our auditors to become similarly skilled in understanding financial instruments as we do expect them to understand inventory or asbestotic-related diseases. I don't think that's too much to ask, and I think it would result in far better auditing.
Great. Thanks for that additional clarification and those comments, Greg. Anybody else want to comment on this subject of specialists? The rest of the team, did we get all of our comments from each of the groups out?
I guess I'd like to follow up on something that Galen mentioned about the specialist report, and the specialist should provide an opinion. What types of reports have you seen, Galen? Do most of them provide opinions, or do most of them have, or is it, I guess it's all over the waterfront, but I'd be more interested in the specialist reports that contain disclaimers saying they're taking no responsibility for assumptions and methods.
I think you hit right on it. I've seen a number of situations where they provide this, some work, and then they give it a disclaimer, and the auditor is relying on that. That is a huge hole for me. If they're going to qualify as a specialist, they have to be a specialist. They can't be something watered down from that. So I would hope that any kind of standard would get it at this, and of course there's lots of different standards. We're talking about many different fields here, and these disciplines, each one of them seems to have their own reporting standards of what they
they can and can't express. And I don't think that necessarily means that they have to express the same type of opinion that we do, but it has to be some level of clarity of the responsibility that they are taking, and that needs to be evaluated by the auditors, whether it's something they can really rely on.
Good. Thanks for that information, Galen. Lynn Turner?
I'd like to come back to Greg's comments for just a second. And as I absolutely agree with everything Greg said about the auditor needing to be skilled when it comes to matters of inventory or other things like that. But I don't think the auditor is an expert in inventories. You just don't become an expert at a company going out there, you know, X number of weeks a year, as opposed to someone who in industry who deals with it day in and day out. And there's definitely a different skill set. The auditor needs to know enough about it and understand it enough to audit it, but they are not experts in that field unless they've gone and done something more to get that expertise, which they might have done. And coming back to the discussion on education that we had yesterday, most business schools in their accounting program and in their business program do not teach people how to do valuations, including of many of these financial instruments. So coming out of school, people don't have the skill set to go do these valuations at the time they pass the CPA exam and get the CPA certificate. It is only if they go through further programs, such as those that the AICPA offer, that one really gets the skill set to really be able to call themselves expert. And a lot of auditors these days haven't done that and don't have that skill set. So I'd be very careful here about starting to tell investors that auditors are experts in some of these instances, as opposed to being an auditor providing a reasonable degree of assurance here. We can go overboard. If you're telling me you got a top-notch expert, that's a lot different than what I think of in the context of an auditor providing reasonable assurance on an issue within an industry.
Thanks, Lynn. That debate, I think, is similar to the debate I was mentioning that took place in the room that I was in yesterday, that where we are on the spectrum of what the auditor has to know with respect to when they engage a specialist, and it's a very complex area such as oil and gas, and an engineer does some work there, what the auditor then has to do with respect to that expert's work. There was some debate about that level of knowledge the auditor had to have around that. So I think it's an area we have to continue to explore. We did have some conversation with Arnold, who was in our meeting, about the ISA and some of the application material that was in the ISA as they thought that through. So as we work on this, where, as I said, a standard that I think we believe we have to work on, there is a debate here about this that we'll be paying a lot of attention to and try to get to the best answer possible. Further input on this? Sam? Sam Renzilla.
Thanks, Marty. I think as I listened to this and participated yesterday, maybe the real issue that you've got to resolve first is what is a specialist? 336 does have a definition of it. Maybe it's not a robust enough definition such that, you know, to Greg's point, core competency versus non-core competency ought to be maybe a place where you think about, if it's in a core competency, there is no specialist. If it's outside of the auditor's core competency, that is a specialist, and maybe that's when you start to determine what the auditor's responsibility is. So maybe even stepping back one step from where the discussion paper was about what should you do, maybe we ought to spend some time thinking about what is a specialist.
That seems to be a very good point. Thanks for that.
Marty, I think Sam is absolutely right. I think, and that came up in our group yesterday. We talked about that. Because we throw around this term specialist pretty loosely. And we've got the standard, and we know what we need to take into account and determine what a specialist is. But once we have a specialist, we sort of have this question: what if he is a what? And then, and with so what? What then? How do we proceed? There's an impact on scope. There has to be an impact on scope. And what is that impact? So I'm talking about the specialist that's working for the auditor now, not the fellow that's inside and controlled by management. But if you have a specialist, what does that mean? And I think that question has to be asked.
So that's further good input, and thanks for that. I think it's clear that this is a complicated area, the use of a specialist, and when the auditor uses a specialist, the definition of a specialist and what the auditor's responsibility is an important question as well. So we've received a lot of good input in yesterday's breakout sessions, further good input today, and we'll take that as we consider the revision to the specialist standards. And again, thanks for the input as well on the discussion on fair value measurements. Certainly we've gotten input that the fraud risk assumption was not widely viewed as a good idea by this group. But with respect to the adequacy of disclosures, we've heard about the importance of those disclosures to investors around fair value and other types of sensitivity disclosures, and important for us to take that up as a matter in terms of what the auditor's responsibility needs to be in those areas. So thank you very much. Greg Fletcher, thanks for teeing up the discussion yesterday and for the input from all of the members of the SAG on these topics.